You see that crap? All that horror crap? Things coming out of crates and eating people? Dead people coming back to life? People turning into weeds, for Christ's sake? You want them reading that stuff? I took care of it. That's why God made fathers, babe. That's why God made fathers.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to The Creep Show. It's October, and you know what that means. Spooky movies, or spooky stuff in general. Brad Shoemaker, Vinny Caravella, how's it going?
I like a spooky time. I don't know if we talk about this recently on the Ramblecast and a bunch of different places. Horror is kind of taken on a real dire, some dire tones, and that this is not that.
No. Creepshow? No, absolutely not. Not even close.
Speak for yourself, man. I am so affrighted after this movie, I can't speak.
Mm-hmm. There are some horror genres in the recent past where it's just like, too real, man. Like, or like, this is just existentially depressing. Like, I don't know why we would... There are horror movies where you're like, I don't know if you want to survive.
No.
Like, maybe the people who got off in the beginning were the real heroes of this movie. But this is some campy fun horror.
There is, yes. There is horror and then there is pure camp.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And this is very much the latter.
Indeed. 1982's Creepshow, a horror anthology film, are kicking off our month of anthologies of varying formats. And this was definitely my first experience with sort of like an anthology-style horror thing. This is one of those movies I definitely caught on HBO or something, like...
Same
probably
here.
Younger than I should have been watching it, though, to be fair, nothing in this movie is like that gross or that nightmarish. Though... Again, my memory of it is primarily Stephen King getting covered in moss and the stuff with Leslie Nielsen and Ted Danson. Like, those were my prevailing childhood memories of this movie.
I knew all the beats from this from being a kid, and they are, as an adult watching it, it is so, you can see the rubber, you know, like you're going back and you can be like, oh, that's a mask.
See the rubber hitting the face, 100%.
Yeah, In my mind, it was so much more terrifying and chilling. All those parts you just mentioned.
Because
Stephen
you were
King,
a child.
I
and
know.
That is why.
Really? Okay. Because this is the first time I've seen this, and it's like hard for me to put myself in the mindset where I would have been scared by this. So it's interesting to hear it did work.
So, like, the Stephen King thing for sure, though I had remembered him doing his final act in a bathtub in my memory, was like so like heartbreaking, and he's like, you know,
yeah, you think
so
it's like the Metallica 1 video. Yeah, like, it's like, totally, oh God, yeah. Oh please, yeah, let them hear me, oh God. But
and
no, it's not that at all.
It's not that at all. And the Leslie Nielsen one was like, oh no, and then like, it's so disturbing. Like, he gets dragged out to the back. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
But like, it's not that at all. And then I always remembered the crate one. There was one I didn't remember. The bug one.
It's the first.
Remember.
Oh, you didn't remember the bug one. The first one, the opener, is the one I always forget is even in this movie.
The dinner.
The Ed Harris one.
Oh, that's because Ed Harris is like, Ed Harris will never do a role like that again.
No, because he's too big now, but also, yeah, I mean, he's basically just like a random schlub in
just
that fucking, in that sketch.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a short one. Like, they're not all evenly paced. That one's like 10 minutes long. And then
that one and the last one are both fairly short.
Yeah, the crate is like maybe a bit too long.
Yeah. For what they're doing there.
Indeed. Well, so this movie, as I said, it was a thing I saw fairly young. Vinny, you said you also saw it fairly young. Brad, you had never seen this before.
No, had not.
Did you know much about its pedigree?
Not really. Well, not beyond what you told me, which is that Stephen King was in it and I guess also wrote it?
He wrote the whole thing.
Which is crazy to me. I've read a fair amount of King and particularly a lot of his short stories, which fit right into this wheelhouse. Most of these don't feel super King to me, with the exception of, what are the...
Well, two of them are King short stories that he adapted.
Is it something to tide you over, I think, is the beach one, right?
Yeah, and that is not a King short story, though, obviously he wrote this for the movie.
Interestingly, though, it has the exact same setup as one of his short stories, The Ledge, of wealthy crime boss catches dashing guy cheating with his wife and puts him through hell.
Yeah, this is just a different spin on that.
But the form of hell he puts him through is completely different, but that setup is the same. The Jordy Verrill one, I guess, feels sort of King.
But that is a King one. That is a King short story. It's based on weeds.
Oh, interesting. I don't think I've read that one.
Okay, yeah, there was one he published in a magazine in 1976. I'm sure it's in one of his collections. But The Crate is also, and it's the same title, is also a short story by King.
Interesting. I'll have to look. I don't think I've read that one either. Also, there's the George Romero-ness of this that maybe overrides the King-ness a little bit.
I don't know if it overrides it, but it definitely adds a layer of bounciness to it that maybe that, like, you know, the nastiest King stuff definitely does not have.
Mm-hmm. Like, my wife and I had this conversation when we were watching the one with King in it, and be like, he is in it. If at any point King were like, this is not the tone I feel like we should be going for, I feel like King and Romero could have had a conversation, but King puts the pedal down and it just is like, this is how I imagine this in my head. This is now when I read any Stephen King, I'm just going to imagine him as goofy as possible.
We will talk more about his portrayal of poor Jordy Verrill as we get there. But, you know, let's talk a little bit about kind of how this thing happened. So this is very much a loving tribute to the EC comics, the horror comics specifically, of the 40s and 50s. They are the ones who, I believe, published the original Tales from the Crypt comics. And a bunch of other things like that, like, you know, like Exciting Tales or whatever the fuck you want to, those things are. That is the publishing company that eventually went defunct, not because they ceased to exist, but because they just only published Mad Magazine after that.
Aw.
So no more horror comics, but Mad Magazine was far and away their most successful thing. Sure. But these were very popular comics in their time. Like, they were definitely, in the way that the opening of this movie kind of frames them as, like, trash garbage that your parents don't want you reading, that, I believe, was very much the perception of them back when, you know, they were actually being published, which is that they were trash garbage for kids that parents did not want you reading.
That's kind of like all comics, wasn't it, in the 50s?
Yeah. Though these in particular were very much like, here, we are showing you the creepiest, most salacious stuff you can show a 12-year-old.
I don't know if they're bad enough to warrant child abuse, exactly.
No, the dad still sucks regardless, but yeah. Yeah. But yeah, these kinds of comics, again, Tales from the Crypt is another thing I grew up on, though mostly the TV series on HBO. I never really read any of the comics because they were not in publication when I was growing up. But this kind of style of extremely pulpy, extremely over-the-top horror is something I'm fairly familiar with, mostly through that TV series and this movie.
Yeah, it's all just short horror is just such a great, or short fiction is such a great vehicle for horror.
Agreed.
I find, because most all horror turns on some kind of gimmick, and a lot of the time the gimmick does not last for 2 hours or 300 pages or whatever, you know, like it's just like a nice bite-sized like morsel to deliver you whatever the trick is very quickly.
Yeah.
I had a couple of Elvira comics as a kid that I feel like were kind of in this vein.
There was a sort of like an 80s reboot of that kind of comic. Yeah. Cause Elvira was very popular in the 80s.
Mm hmm.
I'm not being sarcastic. She was.
No, yes.
Dead and Loving It? Is that the Elvira movie?
What, you mean Dracula Dead and Loving It?
No, that's a different movie.
There were a couple of Elvira movies.
I think Mistress of the Dark is one of them.
Mistress of the Dark is one, yeah.
Yes.
No, I remember, like, you'd straight up see Elvira posters and, like, I don't know, like down at the body shop or something back in the 80s, you know?
But so this was, a loving tribute to EC Comics, which were things that both George Romero and Stephen King grew up reading. And the way that they kind of got in each other's orbit and started working on this project is because of Salem's Lot, apparently.
Oh, okay.
Originally, Salem's Lot, which, as most people know, the original, you know, screen adaptation of that is a TV movie. It is not a theatrical film, but Warner Brothers was originally bought the rights with the intention of doing a theatrical film. And so they brought King in for some meetings about it, and George Romero was one of the directors they were talking to about doing that Salem's Lot adaptation, because he had just put out Martin, which is his one vampire movie, which I don't know if it did very well, but it is pretty well regarded.
Oh my gosh, can I just offer a very timely fact real quick?
Please do.
There is a new adaptation of Salem's Lot coming out in 3 days from the time of this recording.
Yes, there is. I knew that was coming. I wasn't sure exactly when. Salem's Lot has had other adaptations, I think mostly on television, though. Like, there is a Salem's Lot 2, which I believe was also a television movie, and there may have been a miniseries at some point.
Yeah, not to harp on the short stories, but it's also a place that King has gone back to, like, twice.
Yeah.
There's a short story called Jerusalem's Lot that is also there.
Mm-hmm. I have never read Salem's Lot. I have only ever seen the original TV movie, and that is it.
It's just full-on vampires, right?
Yeah, it's just full-on vampires.
I think I may have only read Jerusalem's Lot.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
I have that not read girl, as much King as I maybe should have.
That little girl, man. Some creepy shit.
Mm-hmm. But so, you know, they had these meetings, and then eventually Warner Brothers decided to go in another direction, and as I think George Romero described it, they told him to get lost, because he wasn't doing a TV movie. But him and King kept talking, and they were kicking around the idea of doing some different projects, which were not this, but then I think actually the other thing they were talking about doing was an adaptation of The Stand, and this would have been back in like 1979, 1980, and they realized, oh, we are super not going to be able to acquire the budget to make this thing the way it needs to be made. And so I think it was, I think it might have been Romero who said, or no, sorry, no, it was King who said, you know what, we both grew up on EC Comics, we should do a comic book. And so King was like, great, you know, let's do this. And Romero's like, how long until to get me a script? And he's like, I'll have it done in about 60 days. And on the 60th day, he submitted the script.
It's like, okay, I thought you were going to say like a week, but
he wasn't doing as much cocaine.
Yeah,
that,
I was
going to
say, he had a reputation for just cranking stuff out back then for reasons.
I think by 82, maybe he had dialed that back slightly, but
okay.
But yeah, so, you know, first draft of the script done pretty quickly, and then they just, you know, they constructed these things. Two, as we said, two of them are based on existing King stories, but King did write this entire screenplay, and this was his first screenplay.
Hmm.
And the tone of the thing is extremely comic book. They have these constant stinger screens where people are reacting in horror, which are very much stylized after the way the kinds of imagery you would see in those comics. And then we have Tom Savini here, special effects master, to give you all the weird goopy and puppetry stuff that you need.
I love the comic book stuff looks great.
Yeah.
The animated stuff looks really
extreme.
Good.
Like I'm not going to say I love this movie, but I love the interstitials. Like the comic book stuff is fantastic.
It's really well drawn, and like the stuff that you blend with the live action is done really well. Like the touches that make it feel like a comic book, I think, are done extremely well.
Yeah. Like the opening credits, I got very excited watching the opening credits, which are all animated and comic booky. I'm not going to say all the shorts lived up to that necessarily, but.
Yeah, the thing I will say about the shorts is that when you saw them as a kid, they definitely, I think, resonated a little harder because it is like an early entry to horror. There's just enough there to sink your teeth into while not being so scary that a kid can't stomach it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But
and also, like, the standards were just so different
back
then. Like, the standards for effects and stuff in particular. These were probably, like, pretty respectable special effects at the time, right?
Yeah, they were reasonable. And I think they were pretty well done for the budget that they were operating at this time. That said, as an adult, watching some of these, you really just kind of have to enjoy the camp of it all. Because, like, everybody's acting up to the hilt. You know, as goopy as some of the effects can be, like, they're all fairly cheesy. And the storylines, you know, I mean, they are very basic horror fables. You know, like, they are just, person did bad thing, punishment? You know, that's kind of it.
Wrong, person who was wronged is back from the dead.
Yeah.
Though, I guess my biggest production question for you, unless there's anything really, like, oddball, was the kind of people they have, like a Ted Danson or a Leslie Nielsen, where... Like, are they pulling from a Who's Who kind of Muppet Show style at this point? Or are these...
Kind of.
Okay, so at the time, these actors are doing their careers.
Some of them are.
Okay.
Yeah, like, Hal Holbrook has been around a long time at this point. You know, like, Leslie Nielsen certainly has been doing plenty of film acting, though he has already done the Airplane movies at this point, so he has started to move a little more into the comedy realm. But then, like, Ted Danson, Cheers, I don't think is on the air yet by 82.
Okay.
I think that's right.
And Ed Harris has not really established himself in like a major way at this time, I don't think.
Yeah, I was really trying to nail down his age here because it feels like he could be 30 or 50.
Yeah. Just guys looked like that back then, you know?
Yeah, I think he's on the younger side.
So this isn't a thing where it's like a cavalcade of guest stars where you're just like, oh my gosh, it's him. It's just a mishmash.
I mean, it kind of is, but like not all those stars are that big. I mean, these are people that would have been either coming up around this time or were just big enough at, let's say, the Muppet Show level, you know, like the level of people who are just, you know, they're notable, but they're not necessarily like top lining movies all the
time
here.
Up and comers or in the later part of their career.
Yeah. Like, there's a really tiny cameo, which absolutely no one would ever notice because it's just a guy on a TV screen, but it's fucking Richard Gere during the Something to Tide You Over one.
Huh.
And it's like he's not even credited in it.
Really?
Yeah.
He's just a friend of somebody?
No, he's on TV. Like, he's just a guy who's on TV in the background of that particular short.
Oh, I meant like he's a friend, like, hey, come on set, do this.
Yeah, probably. Or he's just, you know, he's just a working actor that no one really knows yet.
That's funny.
Adrian Barbeau was reasonably big around this time. Like, The Fog came out like a couple of years before this. This is probably around the time she was still married to John Carpenter. But yeah, like, you know, we'll talk about some of the production stuff as we go along here, because there some of it is very specific to certain shorts or what have you. But this was a very, you know, it was an $8 million budget at the time, which was not that small for a horror movie in 1982, but not enormous. But it made its money back. Like, it was and apparently test screenings for this movie were, like, off the charts. Like, Warner Brothers realized they had a hit on their hands, so they started promoting the shit out of it. And yeah, it made, like, 20-something million at the box office, which really wasn't bad for a movie like this back then at all.
It's great. Yeah. It's like a goofy movie. It's like, yeah. You don't get too many things like this, especially these days.
Well,
you know.
Kind of yes and no, because they did make more creep shows. There is a creep show sequel. It was the cinematographer of this movie is the one who directed it, though I think King also did contribute writing on that one. And then there's a third Creepshow movie, which none of the original people had anything to do with. That was from, like, the mid-2000s. But there is also a Creepshow TV series now. It is a streaming series, I believe, which there are at least two seasons of. I have not watched that show, but I've heard it's pretty good.
The closest thing I would say for, and this is a little bit generation below me, it's almost Goosebumps adjacent.
Oh, yeah. Are you afraid of the dark? Or
yes,
that kind of thing. Yeah.
Yeah,
and again,
right.
Tales from the Crypt from our era. Like,
yes.
Yeah.
Right.
This kind of puts it in perspective for me. Not that Wikipedia is the be all end all, but it is reflective of kind of the general opinion of things, you know, or kind of the cultural framing of things. And it describes this movie as a horror comedy anthology film.
Yeah. I would say that's correct.
Like, to see a comedy in the top line kind of like reframes what this movie is for me a little bit. Because when you said it was scary, I went into it expecting like some pretty serious horror and scary for a child, I guess, is the more pertinent way to describe it.
Yeah, it's got a couple of like slightly disturbing images here and there,
yeah.
but very little of it like is stuff that's really going to stick with you if you're watching it for the first time in 2024, you know, other than like, oh, that's kind of neat. Like, it's terrifying.
I can think of like three moments that I was like, oh, like something actually pretty violent or disturbing happened, but we'll get to them.
Yeah. But so the framing device of this movie is just sort of the beginning and end. Like, there really isn't like too much story there. It's just a young kid has his Creepshow comics. His dad, played by The Fogs, Tom Atkins, one of another actor that Carpenter was rather fond of using for a number of years there. He is a shitty dad who doesn't want his kid reading this horror garbage.
I'm talking to you, young man. You want to answer me when I'm talking to you. You remember who puts the friggin' bread on the table around here, don't you?
Stan, don't be too hard on him. All the kids read them.
My boy isn't all the kids. Want to know where this is going, Billy? In the garbage. Right into the friggin' garbage. Now, you got any smart mouth about that?
Now, is any worse than the books you keep in your dresser? Those ones under your underwear? Those Seth books?
Stan, you didn't have to
hit him. Not only do I find out he's reading this crap, he's a goddamn little snoop as well.
No, it wasn't like that! For me to get your coffee on Sunday.
The windows are open downstairs. I better go down and close them. The rain will get in.
No, I'll do it. I got some garbage I want to throw away.
Daddy, please don't throw it away. I'm sorry.
The next time, young man, I find you with a worthless piece of shit like this again, you won't sit down for a week, buddy boy. Remember that. Tuck in.
And so this child, who is fucking clearly being abused by this piece of shit, does the only thing he can do and summons the Creepshow demon to his window to get revenge.
Who hasn't been there?
Yeah. And just, then we just kind of see the pages of this thing, you know, turning as it sits in the garbage overnight.
There's no real indication of how he summoned the demon, right?
Nope. I just assume you read those comics, eventually the demon comes around and is like, how you doing?
He seems pretty psyched that the demon's there, or pretty happy. Like, yeah, all right. Yeah.
Do you know who the kid is?
No,
the only thought I had was that maybe it was one of Stephen King's kids, but I don't know.
It is. It's Joe Hill.
Is it really? No shit.
That is a young Joe Hill.
Okay. I thought it looked like Stephen King. I was like, man, that kid looks a lot like him. I wonder if that's one of his sons.
Yep.
Huh.
Man, not a lot of acting for him to do, but when he leans into it, I think it seems like he's having fun.
Yeah.
And then that's really just the setup. We see the little Creepshow demon pop into the window. That is the only time we see the creeper guy, and he's smiling wide. And then we are off to the races here with our first bit, which is Father's Day. The one I always forget is in this, not because I think it's bad or anything. It's pretty decent, but it's like the least sticky, I feel like, of all of them.
Yeah. This one, like, in the morality play style vein of this stuff is also tricky. I don't know. Is it not well defined what happens
No.
here? They also said the setup is long and confusing with the who's related to whom, and like, is this a
there's
sister?
A lot of there's a lot of that the matriarch of this family
Yeah.
just talking and very like, oh, darling, you don't understand.
Who's coming out, Cass?
You mean Cass hasn't told you about dotty old great-aunt Bedelia, the patriarch of our clan?
Isn't she the one that we're supposed to have...
Well... Supposed to have murdered her father.
Yes.
Bedelia is my aunt, which means that she's Richard and Cass's great-aunt, which also means that she's older than God. But her father, Nathan Grantham, was even older and meaner than that.
All a bunch of dirty vultures just waiting to get your hands on my money.
He was hysterically jealous of Bedelia all his life. Complete Freudian relationship. Then when he was about 184, he had a stroke. And lucky Bedelia, she got to nurse him full time. Then... she met a fella. Yes, sir, a real September courtship.
September courtship? This is October or November at the very least. He was 75. And Bedelia's...
Never mind, my dears. The point is, Henry, Bedelia loved her rather elderly beau, and her own father had him murdered.
Yarborough was the guy's name, and he supposedly died in a hunting accident. That's what's on the books, anyway.
For Bedelia, it was the last straw. She bashed her father's head in with a marble ashtray.
So rumor has it.
Well, however it happened, it was good riddance to some extremely bad rubbish. And my lovely niece and my handsome nephew have very good reasons for being pleased at old Nathan's death. There was no trouble about the will. Share and share alike. And now, every Father's Day, every single Father's Day since his death for 7 long years, she returns to this house, the scene of her crime.
To get to a point where it's just like, no, she killed her dad on Father's Day.
Yeah.
Like that's really the plot device here.
He wanted his cake.
Oh my gosh, that part is... Okay, maybe this is not my favorite.
My cake!
Like, everybody wants to kill this guy banging his cane on the chair, just like, where's my cake? Where's my cake?
Yes, exactly. The great John Lormer as Nathan Grantham here, who is really only in the flashbacks, though there's also the monster version of him running around later. But
it's a good likeness.
Yeah. But so, you know, of actors of note here, Ed Harris is playing this dipshit husband of one of the two dumbass kids of this family. Carrie Nye is the actress who plays the extremely kind of woman who's the matriarch of the family.
I like her. She's pretty good.
No, she's very good.
Yeah.
But the family, and I think this is mostly a recency bias thing for me. The family feels like bad guys in a Columbo.
Sure.
It's that very particular kind of like late 70s, early 80s, like haughty and rich.
Yeah.
That, like, the demon in this could very easily have just been Columbo walking through the door to solve
yeah.
a murder.
It definitely has 80s rich, like, Buffy and, like, you know, not Buffy the Vampire Slayer, like, yeah. Buffy.
Oh,
and with, like,
Buffy.
With sweaters tied around their neck.
Mm-hmm. They're listening
cigarette.
To their disco music.
Yeah.
Cigarette holders and stuff.
Yes.
And so...
Family cemetery.
I never want to live on a property that has a family cemetery. I'm not even that scared of that kind of thing normally, but I just absolutely will not do it.
It's just kind of weird.
It's just weird. But the setup here is that every year on Father's Day, Bedelia, played by Vivica Lindfors here, comes back to the family home to get very drunk and sit outside her father's grave and yell at it for a while, I guess.
Meditate is what the sister says, but yes, it seems like come to terms with maybe what she's done.
Yeah, which seems to be that she killed this dude, and no one seems particularly bothered by it other than, oh, that lady's weird. I mean, the father does seem like a real piece of shit.
Yeah, they do some lip service, especially when she's sitting in front of the grave of, like, you taught us all how to hide it, hide the body, and, like, this guy sounds like maybe he was up to no good in his day-to-day.
I robber baron, at the very least, you know? Yeah. But what happens on this particular Father's Day, while the rest of the family waits inside and smokes and drinks and listens to disco music, is that Daddy comes back out of the grave.
I want my cake. It's Father's Day, Bedelia. I want my cake.
Yeah, what's his cake?
And that is one gnarly-looking corpse, I'm going to say. They actually do a real good job on that corpse makeup.
I think, and the lighting helps, too, you know, like, it's never really got, like, in fact, a lot of the lighting is so stylized in this with, like, the reds and greens and just,
blues and stuff, yeah.
They do a good job of not showing too much of it in too bright of a light. Like, that's probably the most effective, I started to say makeup, but is that even a makeup, or is that more just animatronic?
I think that is makeup. I think that is a guy in a suit. Like, there are there are probably mechanisms making the face do any kind of movement that it needs to do, but that is a suit.
Yeah, like, of the kind of suits and monsters in this, this is probably, might be the most effective one.
Yeah.
He's a thick corpse. Like, he's not like modern day corpses where they can CG out the rib cages and stuff like that. This is a fleshy, full, you know.
There's a lot of moss gathering on that skeleton. A lot of mud still kind of caked in there.
Like grubs moving around in his face.
Mm-hmm.
There's a like you said, a goopiness, but also kind of a density to a lot of the special effects here. Like, somebody takes their time to layer on a lot of stuff in these special effects.
Yeah. And I kind of think everything that happens after he murks Ed Harris, who just kind of wanders outside and then dies after a while of wandering through the graveyard.
Well,
I mean, he does get a gravestone pushed over on him, which is pretty good, but...
I think after my wife was, like, just screaming at it, it's just, move! Just move!
Yep. And then it crushes him. I think he thinks that moving is what's making it fall on him initially, but then he sees the corpse ambling toward him.
Yeah, his unavoidable death as a stone is slowly pushed onto his head.
Look, you're just like those people in Prometheus who kept yelling at Charlize Theron, just run to the side! What are you doing?
Yeah, look, he also finds the corpse of the aunt, right?
Yes, under the dirt.
Yeah.
And yeah, he gets a big old gravestone pushed down on his face, so he's dead.
Yeah. So, you know, the nice thing about these short format ones is they don't really belabor the point, you know?
Like, no.
Yeah. He just kills everyone in very short order.
Though we don't even see the last two people die. Like, what happens is, you know, he finds his way into the house, I guess, and the mother, you know, is skulking around in the dark looking to figure out where everyone is. She finds the cook in the kitchen who is dead, and then she happens upon the corpse ambling around, and then eventually the kids get scared and start looking around for what's happening after they get done disco dancing. Fucking Scooby-Doo episode. And eventually they make their way into the kitchen and they are surprised by their grandfather's corpse holding their mother's head on a fucking plate with a bunch of icing on it saying, I got my cake!
It's Father's Day and I got my cake. Happy Father's Day!
See!
Yep. Yeah, cut to comic book.
I think that's why this one is the least sticky for me, is that the ending just kind of happens and there's not really any big send-off for the last two characters.
Yeah, so I was hoping for it to kind of close the loop just a little bit more in some fashion. The snapping of the mom's neck, though, is one of those moments I mentioned. Oh, yeah. Like, oh, yeah, that's like actually like pretty grisly. You know?
Yeah,
like,
it's not bad.
It's pretty violent. But yeah, like I kind of maybe goes for most of them, at least some of these shorts. I felt like I was just like waiting for just a little bit more plot or a little bit more of a sense of closure, or like for the gimmick to less closure and more like for the gimmick to fully run its course.
The thing I think is interesting is usually when you plot something like this out and pace it, you want one of your strongest at the front and you want your strongest at the back. And I kind of feel like this doesn't do that. All its strongest stuff is in the middle.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think the problem with this one also is like the makeup zombie corpse is kind of frightening on its own. And it kind of takes away from the head on the plate.
Yeah, the head isn't really that shocking.
Yeah, like I think, and they kind of use it as the big reveal, the big shocker at the end. And you're like, no, the corpse guy is the thing that's really terrifying here.
And we've already gotten a pretty luxurious look at that dude. So
yeah.
Now the next one, it is another short one, though I think it sticks a little better, mostly because of our central performer here, which is Stephen King, in The Lonesome Death of Geordie Verrill.
He's going for it.
Oscar. Yeah,
he's going for it, and I want to say right now. And I want to give credit where credit is due. This was the direction for him. Like, this was not him just hamming it up because he's a bad actor. George Romero's specific direction to him was, I want you to react like you're the Roadrunner. I want Warner Brothers cartoon level mugging for a lot of this stuff.
Yeah,
and that is like, what he gave.
It's like just short of having some like boing oing oing type sound effects.
Yeah, totally.
In there.
Like, I thought an anvil was going to fall on his head by the end of it.
Stephen King gets the assignment.
He does, because the thing is, again, this story is not that scary, but it is memorable because he is hamming it up so much, and they do just enough with the set design, with that weird, you know, glowing moss and the creepiness, because Geordie Verrill, all that happens is Geordie Verrill finds a meteor, he touches it when he shouldn't because he's a dumbass.
It's a lunkhead.
Oh, you done it now, Geordie Verrill? You lunkhead!
Yeah, and he thinks he's going to get rich by going to the meteor science department and getting hundreds of dollars. So he puts it in a bucket and touches it with his bare hands, which you should not do with a meteor just because they're hot, let alone, you know, punctuate or, you know, just drenched in death goo or whatever. But he does that, and then his life is slowly taken over by this moss.
Yeah, there's a good vibe to this one. It's not particularly scary, although the ending is kind of melancholy. But, like... It feels very like 50s UFO movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like the look of that moss doesn't look real, but it looks stylized in a way that's like a fun throwback.
Just a lot of goofy lighting and theremin. Yeah, totally.
Yes.
And, you know, I think they don't have a lot of time to work with. The recurring bit of him imagining going to the science department, getting his money.
Damn fine one, Mr. Verrill. How does $50 sound?
Not a cent less. $200.
75.
200. Anita Verrill didn't raise no idiots. Keep a count.
Not a cent less than 200. My meteor, my price.
Then going to the science department and them saying, you were bringing me a broken meteor. You think you can demand money? How dare you?
$200
for a broken meteor? Mr. Verrill, you must be joking. I wouldn't give you 2 cents.
Geordie Verrill, lunkhead. Verrill luck's always in. You spell that kind of luck B-A-D.
And then going to the doctor, who is the same person from his imagination of the other places, and the doctor being like, oh yeah, no, you're fucked. And it's just him, like, it's just his dad. Like, he imagines his dad in every authority role he possibly can.
You ain't gonna get in that tub, are you? Stop watering it at once, Geordie. You get in that water,
Jordy.
You might as well sign your death warrant.
I'm a goner already, Daddy. Ain't I? Got the stuff out of that meteor on me. And I'm gone. Ain't I?
Is that the same actor?
It's the same actor in everything.
Oh, that's good.
And the actor name, I have to tell you right now, is pretty good. Bingo O'Malley.
That's pretty, you're right, pretty good.
That is a George Romero regular, apparently. But his real name is Edward O'Malley, but he goes by Bingo.
Alex, there is a shot in here where he's watching wrestling. Do you know what he's watching?
I'd have to pull it up, but I think what he is watching is some, I want to say, pre-WrestleMania WWF.
Oh, wow. Okay.
It does say the World Wrestling Federation champion.
Yeah.
Defending his title at Madison Square Garden.
Wow.
So that would have probably been Bob Backlund?
Sika the Samoan?
Yeah, Sika the Samoan, who is part of the Wild Samoans and is one of the like big Samoan... There is a massive Samoan wrestling family, which is the Anoa'i family. But like, I think he's part of that. And I think Bob Backlund was the champion around this time, if I remember correctly.
Okay, look, I asked and I got.
Yeah, you got. No, this is one thing I can usually pull something up for.
Yeah, it's black and white, but it's because he's watching a very, very old TV.
Yeah, because he lives out in the country. Like, he is, this movie, he's not bumpkin-coated. It is screaming bumpkin at you.
I mean, he's got prosthetic teeth in, right, or no?
I don't know if it's prosthetic teeth, but they definitely look like they could be. He's got the overalls on. He's got, well, it's just Stephen King's haircut. I mean, that's just kind of what the haircut he had around this time. But
no glasses on him.
No, but the bug-eyed looks he is constantly giving.
It's the eyes in this that, man.
He's really giving you what he has for this thing, which is, again, a fairly thin story. But he is carrying it, I think, reasonably well. Like, this movie, this story could be the least memorable thing in this entire collection, but he's hamming it up so hard, and he's clearly having a lot of fun with it. And it's also just short enough that it does not, like, this is one that I feel like ends when it probably should. It does not linger longer than it has.
Yeah, unlike some of the other shorts here, which I think are maybe a little too long, this one feels just about right. Also, the ending is, like, weirdly dark and depressing.
Yeah.
Please, God, let my luck be in. Just this once. Please, God, just this once.
Yeah, like Jordy doesn't seem like a bad guy necessarily. Like,
no.
He doesn't seem like someone who deserved this, or like, you know. Just
but he made some poor choices.
Seems like a guy who's made a fair amount of poor choices. And
yeah.
Maybe his luck just won't hold.
Like, I always find this kind of like loss of humanity, or like your humanity being taken from you and turned into something else type of story, to be very affecting.
Mm-hmm.
And this is obviously not going for a dramatic version of that.
No.
For the most part. Except for right at the end where it's like, oh God, like he wants out.
Mm-hmm.
This actually is pretty terrible to happen to you.
Yeah, it's not just that it's taking over all the scenery. I mean, it is literally creeping up his body as time goes on. And it also seems like water is like really fueling this thing and making it go much faster.
Yeah. And I enjoy the nod. So this ends in a way that I wish some of these others had a little more, where like, and they don't have the effects budget to do much with this, but that last shot, the implication that, oh, this is actually maybe just going to take over the entire world now.
And in today's weather. Well, not much for the outdoor types, but you farmers are going to love this. The current 30-day forecast released by the U.S. Meteorological Station at Portland calls for moderating temperatures and lots of rain. Castle County is going to turn green so fast in the next month that it's going to be almost miraculous.
Like, this is just going to keep growing. Like, a little something to leave you on, you know?
A slightly apocalyptic note.
Yes, or just a little, you know, like the implication of something bigger or some further consequence than what you see.
And Castle Rock is one of his places, right?
Like that's
yeah, anything that's in like Maine, his, but yeah, especially yeah. Castle Rock.
Yeah, that's kind of like the center of the Kingiverse.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, I do like that shot a lot. I think him in the moss suit is a little like, you can kind of see it sort of dipping in a little bit where his face is in a way that is maybe not great, but they don't linger on that shot for too long. And it is a dark ending. He does just straight up shoot himself. Because yeah, there's no other outcome.
Right. And I think it's the like, he's literally begging God.
Yeah.
I forget how he puts it. Like, please, God, let me.
Is it like, let my luck hold or something?
Let my luck be in just this once, because all he's trying to do is pull the trigger on the shotgun.
Yeah. I mean, the ongoing bit with his character is that he just thinks he has the worst luck in the world. And, you know, some of it is self-inflicted, but it also does seem like that meteor sure did just land in his property of all people.
Yeah. I like this one.
Yeah.
This is probably my favorite one. It's definitely one of the ones I remember the most.
It's the goofiest of all of them, but it is the right kind of goofy, I think. And we'll talk about these other ones here in just a second, but we need to take ourselves a quick break. So we will be right back. All right, we are back, and it is now time for what I'm going to call my favorite of the batch here.
Okay.
Something to Tide You Over, starring Leslie Nielsen and Ted Danson like you've never seen him before, as a drowned corpse.
Oh, you mean like in Cheers?
Yeah, just like in Cheers.
This is nice. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm kidding. Your beloved.
The role that made him famous. Beloved.
Yeah. Okay, how about this? Is it Ted Danson's real hair?
I think it is by this stage, yes.
Are we still, okay. Who's?
I don't think we've gotten to hair plugs Ted Danson yet.
Because it's some nice hair, and he is underwater with those luscious locks flowing.
I'm a regular watcher of Curb Your Enthusiasm.
Uh-huh.
Ted Danson is the object of Larry David's ire throughout that series. Literally, he's in the show. Like,
I thought
they were
friends. I've only seen like season two or three.
So in real life, I think they are friends, but there's a bit in Seinfeld where George is constantly jealous of Ted Danson's success and wants to be more like Ted Danson, especially once they start doing the sitcom stuff.
Okay.
And I think that is just some like an ongoing joke with Larry David that he just hates Ted Danson or whatever and wants to destroy him.
Okay.
Also, Ted Danson marries his ex-wife on that show, so that's also part of it.
Okay.
But, you know, the joke being that seeing Ted Danson in mortal peril is all Larry David wants in the world. So I imagine this is like his favorite thing Ted Danson has ever done.
He watches this over and over.
And the setup for this one, while it takes a little bit to get going, I don't feel like there's actually a lot of wasted time in this. Like all the slow parts still feel like they build towards something good.
Yeah, there's good tension in all of the buildup in this. Unlike Father's Day and I would argue The Crate, which feel like they kind of spin their wheels as they're getting going. Like this feels good and taut right from the beginning.
Yeah.
Cause you know, there's a kidnapped wife who may be under severe duress that you don't know what's going on with her. You know, there's a lot of good back and forth between these two guys. Like there's stuff to sink your teeth into here.
And Leslie Nielsen is very good.
Oh yeah. I'm not sure I've seen him in anything serious.
So you should definitely go back and watch some of his like 60s and 70s filmography before he just officially teetered over into Airplane and Naked Gun mode full time, because he's actually still a really good dramatic actor too.
Yeah.
And everything I've seen him in, he is really solid. It's just that he has an incredible deadpan that makes him a perfect comic lead.
Right.
Yeah, like he's like pretty effectively sinister in this.
Yeah, he walks like a good line between like maniacal and menacing. Like you know, he's like got his thing and it's drowning people.
So while this one is not based on a Stephen King story, it does closely resemble one of his stories. I'm trying to remember exactly which one it is, but there is another one where it is a similar idea of a mob boss tormenting a guy who is sleeping with his wife.
Yeah, that's The Ledge. That's the one I mentioned earlier. Except, again, completely different setting. Like, that's set in a penthouse, high-rise penthouse apartment.
Right. And here, we are out here on the beach, an undetermined beach, but it is one that is clearly, a lot of this real estate is owned by the Leslie Nielsen character. But before that, he goes into the city to go see Ted Danson's, Wentworth?
Wentworth.
Harry Wentworth, that's what it is. And he confronts him because Harry Wentworth has been sleeping with Leslie Nielsen's wife. His wife wants to divorce him. And the character that Leslie Nielsen plays, Richard Vickers, he does not give up things that he possesses so easily.
You found out. All right, Becky and I were going to sit down and tell you pretty soon anyway.
You know, some of these cables are loose, Harry. I'm surprised you didn't notice a change in the quality of your picture.
You know, you ought to be grateful to us. You know that? I mean, if you ever loved her, you don't now. There won't be any alimony, none of that community property shit. She just wants out.
Well, I don't know whether I ever loved her or not, Harry. That doesn't matter. Point is, I keep what is mine. No exception to that rule ever.
Do we think this guy's a mobster, or is he just, I mean, he probably is, right?
I think he's just a rich sociopath. Yeah. I don't think he actually is a mobster.
Or is he just a rich guy?
I think he's just a rich piece of shit.
Okay. I do like that he's like, they allude to maybe or gesture towards him being very techie. Like, oh, I got to take care of this gear.
For the time, yeah. Like like when he goes into the Wentworth's house and he's like, oh man, you know your cable's loose here, right? Yeah. Like, how are you not fixing this? Like, you're getting terrible picture.
Yeah. Like, VCR is not that old at this time.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, and yeah, when you get to his house, like, you see all those monitors set up. Like, he's got cabling that he can just run from his Jeep all the way down the beach. Like, this guy has invested in his rig, man.
Yeah, yeah.
But so, you know, the thing he comes to confront him about is the sleeping with the wife, but he also implies that that wife is in mortal peril. And if Wentworth does not go with him to wherever it is he wants to go and see what it is he wants him to see.
He plays him a tape.
He plays him a tape, but not until later. Yeah, I mean, he plays the audio tape. It's like,
sorry,
please,
the wife
is like, please help, you know, whatever. But he doesn't show him what's going on. Yeah. He has to come with him for that. And Wentworth, like, understandably, is very suspicious about this, but he does go with him to his palatial beach estate.
I forget what he called it. He's got a name for it, but yeah.
Oh, Comfort Points is the name of the beach, and Comfort Station is what he calls his house.
It's very, like, Martha's Vineyard, like, you know, Hyannisport, like, just middle of nowhere island off the coast of New England-style beach.
Look, I'm not going to lie, this looks like it was filmed in New Jersey.
It may have been.
Okay. I was going to say.
I don't know. A lot of this was filmed in the same general area, okay. So it's possible that they were. Though, a lot of Romero stuff tends to be filmed in Pittsburgh.
Mm, I don't think
there's any beaches in Pittsburgh, though. Okay. So they would have had to go somewhere for that. Right. So the thing that Vickers wants him to do is come with him to the beach, and he does. He goes to the beach, and what he wants him to do there is stand in a hole.
That is pre-dug hole, like, yeah,
a pre-dug hole. And Harry understandably does not want to do this. Unfortunately, Vickers also has a gun.
Mm-hmm. Now, Harry, I want you to kneel down and start pulling the sand into the hole.
No way. Go ahead, shoot me if you want to. You're not going to bury me alive.
Not a bad idea. Not exactly what I had in mind, though. All I want to do is incapacitate you, then you can see Becky.
I don't believe you.
I always keep my promises, Harry. And I do have the gun, don't I?
Help!
Yell all you want, Harry. Comfort Point is very private. I own it all.
Help! Help! Help!
Help! Nobody's going to hear you, Harry. Nobody's going to hear anything. Now do what I told you.
And so he, at gunpoint, forces Vickers to stand in the hole while sand is poured on top of him. And then, after he is neck deep in the sand, Vickers comes back with a little television and a mountain of coax cable, plugs that thing in front of him, and shows him what his fate will be, which is already happening to Vickers' wife. She is going to drown with the tide.
Yeah, I love the giant spool on the back of the Jeep.
Mm-hmm.
This guy really has thought of everything. Yep.
Like, it looks just cumbersome enough to be annoying to anyone, but you can tell he's dedicated to making sure this plays out exactly the way he wants it to. And what he's showing him, again, is his wife is buried up to her neck, just like, you know, Wentworth is now, and the tide is rolling in, and Vickers is going to enjoy his revenge of watching them both drown via closed-circuit camera.
There's a chance you can get out of this, Gary. The tide might even set you free. Depends on how long you keep the cool, how long you hold your breath, you see, Harry. The water's so cold, so salty. You're underneath, and you're holding your breath, and you're waiting for that wave that's covering you to go on back out so you can snatch a quick breath. Before the next wave comes in. Well, you've got a chance, Harry. If you don't lose your head. Now, it looks like she's losing hers, doesn't it?
Oh, God, no!
Feel how hard your heart is beating, Harry? How fast? Now, that's going to make it harder for you to hold your breath, isn't it? Oh, the tide. Coming in. Getting late, Harry. Guess I'll have to trot along now.
Wait.
No. You enjoy the show. Please tell the monitor short, sir.
All right. Come on. Stop it.
All right, Harry. I really can't stay.
Now he tells Ted Danson that that's a live shot, not a recording, right?
Yeah, he said she's just much further down the beach, which I assume is the area where the tide rolls in first.
And okay. I think he says it explicitly because he says, no, I'm recording this for me, but this
yeah,
is live.
Yeah, I'm going to enjoy this later.
Yeah.
Not to get too much into the other story that resembles this, the King one, but I was waiting for the reveal that was, in fact, a videotape, that she was already dead all along. But that doesn't seem to actually be the case here.
You guys are pretty big. This is an aside, quick aside here, but you guys are pretty big Star Trek fans. Is that thing that he's wearing around his neck some kind of Star Trek emblem? It looks like Liam Neeson, Vickers that he has.
Leslie Nielsen.
I'm
trying to find a good shot of it. I know what you're talking
about. It almost looks like something from Wrath of Khan or...
No, that's just a kind of baller chain that a rich guy of this particular age group at this time would have been wearing.
It very much looks like some kind of Klingon weapon, but I don't recognize it explicitly.
All right, that's it. Just an aside.
Not quite. It almost matches the little emblem on his like track jacket. Not quite.
Because there is that ashtray that shows up in all of these. Apparently, one that the dad gets killed with. And that looks, and then I think Leslie Nielsen puts like a cigar out in it or something, or it's in the bathroom.
Oh, I missed that.
It seems to show up in all of these. I assume intentionally, not because
that is a great trick. That is absolutely something you should have in any like horror anthology. Yeah. Is a little shared elements that mysteriously pop up. This is just popped in my head. Maybe we get into this more in subsequent episodes of this month. But when Stranger Things was new, and it seemed like that was going to be an anthology where every season was a different story. Like that was the thing I was the most excited about, was like, oh, they can find a bunch of cool, subtle little ways to tie these different stories together to make them all feel like they're one thing.
And then they abandoned that immediately.
And then they made the worst decision. Sorry, Stranger Things fans.
Yeah. No, it's okay. It's, you know, we're way past that now. But I will say, you know, I like a good anthology. I almost wish the Halloween franchise had also made good on that promise, because Season of the Witch was supposed to be the pivot into other stories of horror that are not about Michael Myers. And then that one bombed, so they just made things about Michael Myers for the rest of that franchise.
I get it. Look, I get it. People like get attached to it, and they're like, it's not as good as the other one was, but I'm with you, too. There is something fun to having just short stories.
Vinny, I did look up the thing that you wanted to know.
Okay.
So the vast majority of this movie was filmed in and around Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh.
Okay.
But this one part is the one time they went out of Pennsylvania.
Okay.
It is Island Beach State Park in Berkeley Township, New Jersey.
Okay, yeah, New Jersey making a little appearance here. Maybe he bought that. Maybe he bought that necklace on the boardwalk somewhere in Jersey.
It's in Ocean County. Okay. So, but yeah, so like, you know, the gimmick here is that Ted Danson is in fact going to drown as the tide rolls in, and I think the masterstroke of this particular bit, but also the thing, the pace of this one overall compared to the other ones, is that they give you just enough time with Ted Danson as he is realizing what his fate is going to be. And they give you just enough of him, the water getting a little closer and a little more intense each time. And it builds, I think, just about perfectly to where it eventually ends up, which is his drowned head looking like fucking he's about to go green with David Banner rage.
Yeah, like that shot is great because it makes zero sense that he would still be alive by the time the water was this deep. But still, it's a really good visual of him flailing around and then looking angry and then it turning red behind his head.
There's a lot of just throwing water in these actors' faces. It's like I assume that they are not neck deep in the sand, that they are truly effects here.
But surely not just for safety reasons, but it sure does look like.
Yeah,
it.
They do a good job.
So I definitely had the thought for a second. Surely they didn't really do this, because like it's a lot of water and it looks very convincingly like the tide coming in.
So here's what they did, as far as I can tell. So there is usually when they have to do the like buried up to your neck thing in sand like that, what they do is they dig a hole and you get into it, but then they will put like a layer of like cardboard or plywood or something. Like a thing that would fit around your neck hole, and then they put sand over top of that so it looks like you're buried.
Oh, so you're not constrained actually.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and you can kind of see the lid of that like maybe bouncing slightly every now and again when he kind of moves up and down. The wet sand kind of masks it, but every once in a while it's a little bit obvious.
Yeah, and both of the actors are shot in so close, so tight that you wouldn't need that much area, you know.
But
yeah,
it wouldn't have to be that big of a sand thing to get the shot.
But they aren't throwing water in their faces or some kind of thing is happening.
The fear of drowning, the feeling of drowning definitely hits you at some point watching this in a way that's not fun.
Yeah. And for the shot where it's his head just completely submerged in water, it's basically like he's putting his head upside down into a tank.
Mm.
I think they're pulling him out afterward.
That didn't occur to me that he was upside down, but what that does to his hair in that shot is incredible.
Yeah.
It almost, especially as he starts getting angry as he's dying and it gets red behind him and everything, like the hair is almost like this Dragon Ball looking.
Yeah. He does say, like, I don't think it's true, but Leslie Nielsen does say, you know, look, if you could hold your breath long enough, there's an opportunity for you to dig yourself out of here as the tide goes out. I don't believe that.
Yeah.
Seems like the weight of the water and everything would make that hard, but
yeah.
Scotty's got to use your mojo. But that's, them dying is not the point of this.
No, death is only the beginning.
Yes, right.
In this case, because while, you know, our friend Vickers here is wallowing in his own crapulence and enjoying his revenge, it just goes full on fucking Pirates of the Caribbean here, because these drowned souls start marching their way into his palatial estate.
You know, like the makeup or the suits or whatever here is definitely on the camp end of the spectrum in this movie.
Yeah. It's, you know, the corpse makeup, I think, is like, you know, it's cheesy. It's not amazing, but it's definitely in like a, I mean, I think it's a very theme park monster looking kind of look, you know, it's a big suit, but it's not badly done.
Looking at it again, like the actual corpses look fine. I think it's the way they are draped with kelp everywhere that makes it just starts turning into like the Disney World version.
Also,
and the weird like watery back throat thing they do when they talk, like it's all very like, okay, I'm on a ride here.
We want to see you, Richard.
We want to see you.
We want to see you,
Richard.
We dug a hole for you, Richard.
On the beach
below,
but it's good and it's effective, and I do think the amount of time they spend on, you know, Leslie Nielsen kind of like bopping around his house trying to figure out what's going on, I think is, again, well done.
Yeah.
And when they finally burst through the door, it's like, okay, it's on.
It's ominous as his paranoia is building, and then the bit of him repeatedly shooting them and it not stopping them is really well done.
Like, especially the part where they shoot him in the head and then just dank water.
That looks
starts,
pretty
like,
good.
Out of the
I
hole.
Think that's
right.
Pretty gross.
Right. Right. But also, you know, like a gun, like violence is the only leverage this guy has. And now that that's not working for him, he's fucked.
Yeah.
And he knows it.
I will say, I think Leslie Nielsen's performance as things start going more and more haywire is really good. I think the cackle he has at the end is exactly what that scene called for. But also, there's a reason why he's cackling the way he is. And also, this was an ongoing thing with him on set. Leslie Nielsen is a prankster. He is legendarily known for playing jokes on people on set. Not mean stuff, like just goofy stuff. And his favorite thing in the world is a fart machine.
Okay.
And apparently the entire time they were filming this, he had the fart machine with him, and he was making it go off at random intervals, and he was making the crew laugh constantly because farts would just emanate from nowhere, and he would just start laughing.
What a card.
The man loved a fart joke.
Look, he found his calling with later on when it came to Airplane, or this is after Airplane, you said?
This is after Airplane, I think even after Airplane 2.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I think Airplane 2 was 80.
Yes, and Naked Gun stuff, so...
Yeah.
All the farts you want, Leslie.
Yeah, Naked Gun hadn't happened yet, but Police Squad had.
Okay.
Now, my real question at the end of this, and this is unanswerable, but were they ever even actually there?
Well,
someone had to bury him in that sand.
He could have just buried himself. Yeah.
Could have done it himself.
Like, do you think he went crazy and buried himself in the sand?
But the fact, there is the kelp draped over the camera at the very end when he's out there on the beach at night.
And the footprints, the two sets
of footprints. And the footprints into the ocean, yeah.
Oh, I missed those.
Yeah,
there's footprints, but it looks like corpses shuffling off into the ocean.
Oh, yes. Okay, I forgot about that shot. Maybe that does maybe answer this a bit more definitively.
But, like, you know, I think the thing that's not defined is, like, what animated them? Was it the power of the sea? Was it God?
Vengeance.
Like, what is it that brought them back? Vengeance, seemingly, yes. And so he is left in the sand, cackling to himself, "I can hold my breath for a long time."
It's pretty good until the freeze frame, which is, I mean, they do on all of these, but it's just like, it's a very...
I like his little mug, though. Like, a little like, oh, no, I'm fucked. Actually, I'm really fucked here.
Yeah, that's actually one of the better freeze frames of like, oh, because he's very confident in his scream, but then not. Good one. It's a solid
one. This is definitively my favorite one. I like the crate, too, but this is my favorite.
This one and Jordy Verrill, I think, work the best for me, for sure.
Same here. I think the crate, for me... it's a little like, even as a kid, though we're going to get to it in a second, there's just straight up murder. I don't think I truly understood the like bad relationship stuff. Like, it's like not something that I probably could relate to with a spouse or something in the crate, but everybody could relate to touching stuff and putting your fingers in your mouth.
Come on, man. You can't relate to the idea of women. Am I right, guys?
Yep.
I just want to play some chess.
Listen, I do think the sort of like battle axe of a wife aspect of this is maybe not the thing that has aged the best, but
just,
I mean, she sucks.
Waiting to go that old battle axe.
Yeah, but she is. There's
but
a couple
like
of things in here.
Cartoonishly awful.
Yeah, I mean, she's beyond like, oh, my wife, the ball and chain. She is horrible. There's a couple of other things in here which age, I think, even more poorly with the like accusations of what the other professor is doing.
Yeah, and the way she reacts is like, oh, wow, I gotta go see this.
Totally,
like, are you kidding me?
Yeah.
Yeah, that aspect does not age well.
Like, you have like a young co-ed coming up to this professor at this garden party, like sort of making eyes at him, right? Or like, I'll see you later. It's like, that's just kind of like glossed over. Yeah.
But yeah, she goes beyond the like, the old ball and chain won't let me play chess. She's
an alcoholic who is actively abusive.
Yeah, she's like drunk at this party, right? Like, kind of embarrassing him.
And so let's talk about what the story is and the players are here. Hal Holbrook is our henpecked husband here, Henry Northup. His wife, Wilma, otherwise known as Billy, played by Adrian Barbeau. And then Fritz Weaver is his professorial friend, who gets into a bit of a fix here. These are actors that I would say definitely fit the mold of what you would think a college professor in 1982 would be like. Do you guys know like Hal Holbrook particularly well?
I the name sounds familiar and he looks familiar, but I couldn't tell you anything about him.
He is well known as the actor who has done the most performances and is widely considered the best impressionist of Samuel Clemens.
Huh.
Okay.
Interesting. That's an interestingly specific claim to fame.
Yeah, Mark Twain is like the character he has sort of slid himself into on a regular basis, and he has played Mark Twain on the stage in a number of different things over the years.
Interesting.
Okay. He's also the bad guy in Flesh Lips. That was the first thing I ever saw him in.
Okay, well, a little slightly different, but yeah.
Yeah, slightly different tone. He was also in The Fog with Adrian Barbeau. He plays the priest in that movie. But that is kind of his claim to fame. And yes, his wife is a terror. He is sort of stuck dealing with her. And then at this garden party that they were having at this university.
Henry and Wilma Northrup.
Oh, just call me Billy. Everyone does.
Billy?
You need someone to show you the ropes, hon. You just come see me. I know all the best stores.
Well, nice to meet you.
Pleasure to meet you.
So, are you buying or renting?
Oh, actually, we're renting at the moment.
Oh, it's just as well. Buying real estate in a college town is a friggin' pain in the ass. You take my word for it.
Henry is in the English department, and Wilma...
Oh, I just take care of Henry. Believe me, he needs it. Did you ever meet a man who didn't? What's the matter with you two? You're not drinking?
Well, actually, we just got here.
Oh, well, we can take care of that. You just come on with me. Henry, you stay here till I get back.
Excuse us, please.
Yeah, nice to meet you.
But then a little bit later, Professor Stanley, Fritz Weaver's character, is back at the old office because he gets a call from the janitor, played here by Don Kiefer, because he found something under a staircase in a crate.
I don't know. I started to say, like, this one is super long, and I started to say I almost would have wished this was half the length and we could have gotten another short, but they probably didn't have the budget for another short.
No, in fact, one of the other shorts, like the one that's after this, almost didn't make it in the movie because they were running out of budget.
But even then, the movie is 2 hours long. I really feel like this could have been shaved down 5 minutes at
five
least
or 10,
to just
kind
of get you into the core horror of this faster.
I think as we go here, like, we're up to the janitor and this guy finding the box, but I think there's actually one death and whole thing too many. Like, it doesn't seem that, like, we don't need the grad student there or the student there.
No, that part is a little extraneous. I think they just needed to up their murder count more than anything else. But I also think this is the one that is the most like the short story. It's like this because this is how the short story is.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I went and looked up this and Weeds. Both were never published in any of his collections.
Just in magazines, I think.
They were just in magazines, so that's why I have not seen them.
Yeah.
Yeah, and even some of the editing, I don't know, like as they're kind of creeping around looking at the box, you know, and like when they're opening the crate and stuff, like some of it just feels like it's a little too languid and drawn out.
I mean, again, I think as like an early entry for horror for younger people, like that buildup of, you know, something is in that crate, you know, it's probably murderous, and them kind of just like keeping you on tenterhooks for a little bit, it works okay. I think as an adult, we've seen too much stuff like this, and it just feels like it's dragging getting to the point.
Sure.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes, I agree with that. And I think also just an actual physical monster in the crate is maybe like ding, ding, ding on the nose versus like a mist or nothing in the crate.
Yes.
Yeah.
Evil.
It's a weird one. It's a weird one because they go out of their way to say that crate has been sitting there for 150 years.
Yeah. From an Arctic expedition. That's what it says on there.
Like, you kind of don't expect like a living creature to have just survived in this crate without any food and without making a sound for that long.
I imagine like on some level they are imagining this as like demon adjacent, whether or not it is actually, you know, a living being or something that is conjured and has just been trapped in this crate forever. You don't really know. It's something that thawed out of the ice and then suddenly is just, you know, is somehow still alive because its constitution is insane. I don't know. But whatever the case, there is a straight up fucking like toothy Harry and the Hendersons monster in there that wants to eat you.
When they do the shots of just the eyes of the monster, which they do several times, like the full on Star Trek, like lighting across the eyes thing, the eyes look incredibly frightening.
Yeah.
Like they look very, very sinister. When you get the full face shot of the monster, it kind of undermines that a little
like
bit.
Like you almost think that thing is at some point just going to start talking and saying, "Feed me, Henry." Yes.
Or like it's a little Muppet-esque, or like a little
like a mean Muppet, but yeah,
like a Big Trouble in Little China, like the monster in that thing. But yeah, this the janitor, he gets his
after they spend a long time figuring out how to get nails out of this crate. That's probably the part they could have cut, was maybe like a minute of them getting nails out of a crate.
Yeah, that's the type of stuff I'm talking about. Or when he's trying, or when the grad student is creeping around, like there's just like a couple minutes too much of them just sort of creeping around.
Yeah.
I do like we kind of passed over it, but there it is interesting when the main husband has his fantasies about offing the wife. Those parts are
Henry
interesting.
Henry has a rich fantasy life, and most of it involves his wife dying.
Yeah,
that first one where he whips out the gun at the garden party, like really caught me by surprise.
Yeah.
I was like, wait, which direction is this going?
Mm-hmm. And like everybody claps.
Good job, Henry. Good job.
Yeah. Oh, perfect shot.
I mean, again, Adrienne Barbeau is really leaning into the shittiness of this character. I will give her credit. She makes this character unbearable in the way that I think the story calls for. It's not her fault that the writing is really over the top. It just is like that.
No, she's like as over the top as Stephen King is in his...
She's mugging like, in a different way.
Yeah, right.
But it's a while before Henry really gets pulled into this thing, because after the janitor is pulled into this thing... the professor goes running screaming out of there, all belligerent and crying and not sure what he just saw. And while that goes on, the beast just straight up drags the crate back to its spot under the stairs, which is maybe my favorite little dumb bit anywhere in this thing.
It's like, well, I have this little safety hole.
That is pretty goofy.
It's where it's been safe all these years.
Mm-hmm.
And as he is blabbering through the hallways, he comes upon this one random grad student who is just enough of a dipshit that you know he's going to die violently. And I'm with you. I think they take maybe just a little too much time getting you to that part that you know is coming. But when he dies, it is far and away the most gnarly and I think the most successful death of this particular short.
Sure.
Yeah.
Is it? It's not really here nor there, but is that just a random grad student or is it the one they're talking about at the party early on who's going to win the Nobel Prize?
I think so.
I think that is him. Yeah. He's working there too late and the whole thing.
And I'm glad they said grad student because this is another one of those actors that either is playing someone who is supposed to be in their early 20s or someone who is supposed to be in their 50s, and you are never able to quite figure out exactly where they are supposed to land. Where they land is dead and just absolutely shredded by this thing. Because they.
Or like.
That creature just lays into this dude.
He gets his own, prosthetic face.
Yeah. Like, that's, I mean, it's like. I don't want to say it's bad makeup, but it's obviously very not real.
Yeah.
But it still looks pretty good.
It's good rubbery.
Like, yes, that's, yes, exactly.
He breaks his face.
Yeah.
Like the, is it teeth or claws that he uses where he literally just takes a giant chunk out of his neck?
That is, so he takes the chunk out with his teeth, but then there's a big slash with the claws also.
Right. Yeah.
And that's the one that really fucks him up at first.
Well, you got to give it to Charlie. He does go for a whack with that wrench, right?
Yeah. He tried for it.
He did attempt.
He gave it a shot. Didn't work out.
No.
And then our friend Dexter Stanley goes to his only friend, the only person he can turn to, the guy he was supposed to play chess with that night, Henry Northrop. And he blabbers about what he found to a understandably disbelieving Henry, though the wheels start turning pretty quick when he gets a sense of what might actually be happening there.
Last time I saw someone do that was in the movies.
It could be my ass. It really wasn't me. It was that thing in the crate. I don't even know what it was.
What two people? Who is dead?
Mike, the janitor in Amberson Hall. Charlie Garris. He wanted to measure the bite marks, Henry.
I guess he got his chance. I surely guess he did. I can't do anything for you unless you stop being so goddamned elliptical. Now, just slow down. Tell me the whole story from the beginning. Can you do that?
Oh, all right. I think I can do that now. Oh, thank God for you, Henry.
It doesn't seem like he's too unbelieving for too long.
No.
Yeah.
I don't think he can imagine a scenario where this guy would come running in making some shit up about this.
But there's opportunity.
There is opportunity. And so he drugs his friend to keep him from stopping him from doing what he's about to go do, which is set up an elaborate murder of his wife using a demon beast.
Yeah. It's maybe a little thin. The plot is a bit thin, but... She seems very game to believe his note and come over in the middle of the night.
And again, let's say what's in the note here. He straight up says that his friend raped a girl.
Yep.
And that he is he has gone over there to try and help, A, console her, and B, figure out what to do. And right. He needs her help.
It's very much like, hey, I got to cover this up. You got to come see this.
Yeah.
When Dex called me, he was barely coherent. He was gibbering with fear and crying, I think.
Poor Dex.
I tried to get him to tell me what had happened to the girl, but for the most part, he only kept repeating, "It's awful, Henry. It's awful." Wilma, could you come out here? I know it's asking a lot, but you're always so clear-headed about these things, and you know how to be firm. I think Dex could use a firmer hand than mine right now, not to mention the girl herself. He said that she had curled up in a dark place and won't come out. I'm sorry to have to ask you to come over to Amberson Hall and help me out. But as you so often say, what would I do without you?
What indeed, Henry? What indeed?
Like, you know, you're always so good at these things. It's like somehow, like, with people.
Well, that's the big thing, is that she's incredibly condescending to him and treats him like, you know, he's a child. So, in her mind, he's playing into that and into what he knows she would react to, which is to say that he's helpless and he needs her help.
What would you do without me?
And this is another part that I think maybe just goes on a little too long, because the part of him taking his time cleaning up the blood, you know, while he narrates this long note about what happened here, and she pours her fucking bourbon into milk or whatever it is she's drinking there.
What in the world is that?
It's like an off-putting detail, but I also wonder if maybe people in the 80s were just drinking a lot different than we were.
Yeah. Maybe they didn't have Clue yet.
Yeah.
Just have some milk.
Well, we were also drinking a lot more glasses of milk back then. I think that's maybe not as popular a thing now, but, you know, he's setting it up so that when she gets there, he can put his plan into action, which is goad her into going into this area around the crate, and hopefully the beast will eat her.
Yeah.
The beast he has not even seen yet.
No, I mean, he's seen all the blood because he's cleaned it up, but yeah, he's putting a lot of faith into the mechanics of how this works.
Yeah, because again, there's nothing left behind. It's not like, you know, there's pieces of people lying around. There's blood stains and maybe a couple of tattered pieces of clothing, but that's kind of it.
Some glasses.
Has that thing been shitting in this box this whole time?
Look, we don't really understand how this works, okay?
The mechanics are a little weird.
He does question it, right? He's like, how do they fit in there?
Maybe it was hibernating.
Well, whatever the case, you know, when she gets there, you know, he kind of gets her to go close to it, but she is maybe starting to suspect something is a little weird. And then he just sort of shoves her toward the box. He's like, come on, eat her.
I think this is the final example of something that is just, it's just portrayed a little awkwardly, the back and forth between them, him trying to get her to go over there, her resisting. I don't know, something about it. The dialogue, the performances, it just kind of doesn't quite work.
They're just kind of puttering around.
Yeah, yes.
Yeah, she gets her last digs in, though.
Yeah.
Before getting eaten.
Oh, yeah, no, she gets to savage him for a little bit before she herself gets savaged by this beast.
Same old Henry, afraid of your own shadow. You know what, Henry? You're a regular barnyard exhibit. Sheep's eyes, chicken guts, piggy friends, and shit for brains. No good at departmental politics. No good at making money. No good at making an impression on anybody. And no good at all in bed. When was the last time you got it up, Henry? Huh? When was the last time you were a man in our bed? Now get out of my way, Henry, or I swear to God you'll be wearing your balls for earrings. And I swear to God, if you ever
just tell it to call you Billy.
Surprisingly, the one that we've been building the most toward, we don't get to see as much of the death. It is more implied than the grad student who we barely know and who gets the most violence done to him that we see. I mean, I'm sure that Janitor didn't come out very well either, but we don't really see a lot of that.
He got his arm for a bit.
Yeah.
But she just kind of disappears.
Yeah. And then he has to try and chain this box back up, which is maybe the single most tense thing anywhere in this one bit, is just him just handshaking, trying to get that lock closed.
Which he does.
Yeah.
Yeah, that part's all right.
But then the solution to it in the end is the most like, we got to end this thing. What's going to be the stinger? What's going to be the moment of actually this could still go wrong? Is that the next morning, as him and his friend are playing chess, he describes the way in which he carted the crate into his car and then dropped it in the local quarry, which is, of course, flooded. And he's like, that thing's underwater. There's no way it could ever come out.
Oops.
Or this thing that has been alive for 100 years.
Right. Yes, this thing that also lived without food for 150 years maybe is not also not going to be stopped by drowning.
No. The only thing I do kind of like about the ending of this is the bit of like, well, I did a hell of a thing for you there.
Yeah.
Guess you're going to have to pay me back by playing me chess twice a week.
Yeah.
Sure.
For the rest of your life.
Yeah. Well, there's that I think there's that bit earlier where the professor also is worried that he's going to get these deaths are going to get pinned on him, right? So there's like kind of a back and forth code of silence here.
Yeah. But, you know, that it's a little strangers on the train if only actually one of the strangers committed intentional murder. But yes, I mean, the big stinger is, oh, the monster's probably going to get loose. And then not we assume that we'll come find them and kill them.
Probably not as the forensics here, probably not as great.
No.
For all these missing people and definitely all the blood that was left behind.
Yeah, I mean, that dude was married. People might ask, hey, where's your wife?
Where's your wife? Where's this grad student? Why are these bloody rags all here?
Yeah, she went off to, she ran off with a grad student and a janitor. They're a throuple now, and I wish them the best.
Where's my crate?
Yeah. And then we have one more here. I'm going to say maybe third or fourth on my list in terms of favorites. It's mostly just the performance of E.G. Marshall in this one that I do really like, who plays Upson Pratt, a well-to-do New York financier of some magnitude, and a insane germ freak.
I had forgotten about this one. Maybe I didn't watch this one because the bugs are extremely disturbing. If you have a bug thing, this one's not for you. They go.
Oh yeah, this
all
is bug stuff all the way.
Yeah. But I do like the set piece aspect of this one. Like
yes.
Yeah, this is a weird one because there's a lot going on here.
In a fairly short amount of time, too, because this one's one of the shorter ones.
Like, there's this his profession, but his germophobia, which then leads to this kind of bizarre environment that he lives in. And, like, there's a lot of what seems like, for the time, like, pretty advanced technology that you're sort of trying to parse in the middle of all this.
Like, his house looks like a set from Star Trek.
Yeah.
Right. That's what it is. High concept, maybe, is the word I'm looking for. Like, it's just, there's kind of a lot to take in here.
So, well, let's get the log line here, which is that Upson Pratt is a huge piece of shit. He lives in seemingly, like, total seclusion in this, you know, very advanced penthouse that also has the look of a hospital. Like, it is a sterile white environment. I assume white specifically because that means he can see any speck of dirt, any bug, anything, which he will instantly get rid of because he is terrified of germs. And all he does is communicate with people through the door and the telephone when he needs something. It does not seem like he goes out very much.
Mr. Pratt, I got to the office here and I found a telex from Seattle that I thought you'd want to hear.
What are you doing in the office at 9:30, George? There's no overtime at the executive level, you know.
Oh, yes, sir, I know that. It's about the Pacific Aerodyne takeoff.
Bugger Pacific Aerodyne. They're done for. They've had it. Norman Kassenmeyer's a dinosaur. He's too fucking blind to find his way into the nearest tar pit.
Mr. Pratt.
Air pollution counts up to almost 7, George. People are out there on the streets dying of carbon monoxide poisoning, and they don't even know it.
Yes, sir. But
I found another cockroach this evening, George.
Oh, no.
One of those big ones. Right here in my $3,200 a month penthouse apartment. My supposedly germ-proof apartment. Now, would you like to tell me, George, how an apartment can be germ-proof when it's not even bug-proof?
Yes, it can, Mr. Pratt, but I want you to know that Pratt International now owns a majority of Pacific Aerodyne stock.
Of course we do.
Well,
I can't talk to you now, George. I'm going to clear up this damn cockroach problem once and for all.
No, I do like his, like, whatever disposal unit he has, too, in there. His vacuum tube.
Yeah, that thing's pretty neat. He's also just a huge asshole.
He's
huge. Like, we made clear repeatedly, like, he gets off on destroying people financially. Like, gets off on threatening his employees, you know, being casually racist.
Yep.
Not too casually, though.
No, like, very, very, very intensely racist. And also, just, like, seems to delight in ruining people that he sees as, like, problematic for him. And one of the big running things in this is that he has made some kind of deal that caused a business rival of his to commit suicide.
And then kind of mocks that whole process to the widow.
Like, the wife calls angry about it, and he basically sort of makes fun of her.
Yeah.
His eyes were so dead. I asked him what was wrong. What could be so bad to make his eyes look that way? And the only word he could say was your name. 10 minutes later, I heard the shot.
Yes! George Genron told me old Norman went out with a bang.
How many men have you destroyed? How many men have you killed, you monster?
Only the stupid ones. Only the ones who handed me a knife and then stretched out their throats. Only the ones who, if you'll pardon the expression, fucked up. Now, if you'll excuse me, I've got this bug problem, so we'll have to defer your charming conversation for another time.
I hope you die.
By the way,
I hope you get cancer in the worst place.
Mrs. Katzenmeyer.
Leprosy. Screaming hell for it.
Mrs. Katzenjammer. Would you mind telling me who gave you my private number? I'd like to fire him.
He was in my husband's address book, you son of a bitch.
Oh. Well, I can't fire him, can I?
And, you know, clearly everyone hates this guy, but he's incredibly rich, so they just sort of cater to him to some degree. But this night in particular, this dark and stormy night in Hell's Kitchen, he is, in fact, plagued by bugs. Specifically, he begins finding cockroaches around his apartment, and this aggression will not stand.
I have a very silly question here for the movie buffs out there, and maybe this is something that's changed over time, but can you harm a bug in the making of a movie? Can you kill a bug?
I also wondered about that.
Well, so my understanding is, and this is one of the ones I caught the most special effects stuff about.
Okay.
Specifically because I was curious, like, did they kill a bunch of these bugs or what happened? So they imported these bugs, I think, from the Dominican Republic. There was somewhere in the neighborhood of 18,000 of them, I believe.
Oh, man.
But the vast majority of what you see on screen is not even bugs. There is, like, raisins and nuts and other things, underneath. Layer of bugs.
Yeah, you see that. Yeah, you see that for sure.
So it's not, you know, it's not like all of those are live animals. But so what happened is when they were done with the production, they were supposed to get rid of all of them because those are not native cockroaches. Those would technically be considered an invasive number of cockroaches from a foreign soil. And what they said, the quote I found was, "We don't know how many of them got away. We think a lot of them got away."
Okay. I mean, that's a lot. Were they like euthanize them, or they like they have to send them back to Dominican Republic?
I don't know because you can't kill a cockroach. No one has ever actually successfully killed a cockroach. It's impossible.
Okay. Anyway, so I wondered in this because it is a lot of bugs, and he's spraying them with what looks like water. I don't know if it's actually any kind of.
I think the cans are just water.
Yeah, but like, it definitely made me question immediately of like, oh, this is our. This is the 80s, maybe anything flew, or are there protections for other animals? But
I think the regulations around this time were definitely looser than they are now.
But yeah, this is a thing. This whole bit and this whole scene is bug drama and grossness.
High
and
bug
fear.
Drama.
And it's pretty effective because they definitely do the thing of, what if there were a bug here? And you're like, yeah, that's gross. Mm-hmm. Yes.
There are bugs just crawling all over everything, getting into everything while he has his phone calls. One of the people on the phone, by the way, is Ned Beatty in an uncredited role. Just, you know, it's Ned Beatty. Yeah. I love Ned Beatty. But I think this one works specifically because E.G. Marshall is really good at this kind of piece of shit.
Yeah,
he plays the character well. I think I needed just one little extra hook in the story here to kind of justify what was going on a little more.
Yeah,
like I feel like you get that with a lot of King stuff, like some element of like dramatic irony or some morality where like the guy that this guy ran out of business who killed himself was an entomologist or, you know what I mean? Like some sort of just desserts
bug freak
coming into play here.
I feel like it almost gets there at the end. Almost. Yeah, like, it's like a scene away.
Like I don't need the practical explanation of where did these bugs come from, but more something, like I said, more something specifically why this character is getting these just desserts the way he is.
Yeah.
Well, like at the very end, there's almost like a little wink of like, maybe there were no bugs ever. Maybe he just died of like being alone and being an asshole and like his worst fears came true. But
no, they actually just crawled inside him.
Yeah, really.
Which we find out before he dies, like he locks himself in the soundproof room from Sneakers and is supposed to be, you know, basically that's supposed to be his like bug out room, like his like nothing can get me in here. But guess what's in there?
More like bug in.
Yeah. Because there's bugs in that room and it goes real bad for him. I don't know if he has a heart attack or if he just is choked to death by the fear of all these things crawling on him, but he sells it, is what it is. Again, Marshall, I think, gives a really good performance in this story, which is a little underbaked, but he really sells like the horror and the franticness of his immediate demise.
You'll never get in here. Never. And when this blackout is over, people are going to pay. Oh, yes. And you'll pay, too. Every one of you. Every damn one of you. I've been beating bugs all my life. And I'll beat you, too. Bastards. Talk to me.
Pratt. You old monster. Oh, I hope you die.
I hope you die. I hope you die.
And the stuff that happens after he's dead is like maybe the most actually revolting thing in this movie.
Yeah, because as the building guy, Mr. White, who is mocking him through the door, we see his corpse laying
rightfully mocking him
because he was a total asshole to him beforehand. All we see is his corpse in a completely clean room, like there's no bugs around anywhere, until the flesh of his face starts to bubble a little bit, and then bugs start pouring out of orifices that weren't even there before.
Yeah.
And then like split his chest open and start coming out of there in the hundreds.
This is a Tom Savini special, folks.
It's like the, you know, if you look at the corpse at all, obviously it's not real. Like it's pretty obviously rubbery, but still just the visual of all these roaches crawling out of this man's mouth and,
It's great and horrible. Again, yes. It's not the most memorable story in this. It's not, you know, it doesn't, I'd say it's very solidly in the middle for me, but good, gross ending to it.
It's really gross. How do you think you get the bugs to pour out like that? You think you have like,
I imagine what you probably do is you have that thing set up so that certain points on it start to bubble up and open up. Specifically, and then there's like a device underneath that like pushes things up through it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Pretty gross.
Again, Tom Savini, one of our great special effects wizards.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of how that's the last of the big fables, though there is the little bit of wrapper here at the end. The next morning, the garbage men, one of which is played by Tom Savini.
Which one?
The one with the mustache.
Mustache guy.
Okay. Yeah.
And so, you know, they find the comic and they're looking through it. It's like, I used to love these comics. Hey, you could send away for a voodoo doll. Someone already ordered that. Let's see what else we can get.
I wonder where this is going.
Mm-hmm. And Tom Atkins, the next morning, boy, he's having these weird pains in his neck.
Oh, it's this goddamn stiff neck. I can barely move my head.
You must have strained it.
Yeah, I guess. I don't know. Ow!
Well, you poor old bear. You want me to get some Bengay?
No. Ah. Oh.
Oh, teach you to throw away my comic books. Ready for another shot, Dad?
It's because his son is stabbing a voodoo doll in the neck over and over again. Yeah, and now he's going to die because his son couldn't have his comic book. I don't think Joe Hill had a great future in child acting, but I really enjoy the like, as he's stabbing it is really good.
Mm-hmm.
And that's it. That's the end.
That's it. Yeah, I like this. I mean, like, it's entertaining and fun, and it will have a place in my memories as a child. It's a young adult, like we said before, like Goosebumps, Are You Afraid of the Dark style thing.
Yeah.
That that probably still hits for the tween crowd, I would think. I was going to watch this with the kids. They watched the trailer and they opted out, but I think they could take it.
I think they could handle this for sure. Again, I saw way more disturbing stuff around the same time I saw this one. I just remember enjoying it, just thinking it was very novel, very fun, and enjoying Leslie Nielsen especially.
I would be more curious what kids would less from the like, is this too scary, and more like, would they believe it? Like, because they're so used to like hyper realistic special effects now and stuff. Mm-hmm. Like, does this actually play for kids these days? I don't know.
Well, yeah, one probably. I should watch it with the kids. We'll find out.
You can always check out the like I said, the Creepshow streaming series, which there's actually 4 seasons of. I just realized. So you know, you could see if that stuff maybe is more their speed.
Especially since Tales from the Crypt will never see the light of day.
No.
We'll stay in the crypt forever.
Man.
It's okay.
Listen.
I also watched a ton of that show.
Those DVDs are still out there. You can still find them occasionally. So, you know, you're just never going to get a new release of those things, unfortunately.
What is the deal? What is just a rights
thing? It's a rights thing. And I don't know exactly where the rights problem is, but there were so many people involved in that thing, like Walter Hill, like you know, like the HBO, the original EC Comics people. Like, there's just so many different rights aspects, and also just such an incredible array of actors that I have to imagine you have to get them to sign off on likeness rights for all that stuff if you want to do a new release.
Oh, well, we don't need to spend too much time on this. Just very quickly looking around, it looks like this might be a Star Trek situation from the 80s where they shot it on film, but then did all the mastering on video. Mm-hmm. And they just may not have that original film anymore.
Oh.
So rights stuff, even if the rights stuff was cleared up, they might not have the source material to scan for a high res. Like, DVD quality might be the best we could get anyway.
Yeah, it's just the bigger thing is it just isn't appearing on streaming anywhere. And I think that's where the rights stuff really gets weird.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah. But so Creepshow, where does it land on your list, Vinny?
Oh, I've got it between Somehow This Makes Sense to Me. It is between Dread and Darkman. It is
I can see it.
Yeah.
Both pulpy movies in their own way.
Ninja Turtles. Yeah, right, exactly. It's in that block.
You're in
it's
the pulp section.
It's around Dick Tracy. It's around Halloween. Yeah. It's around In the Mouth of Madness.
Yeah.
It's above Darkman. Yeah. It's below Mortal Kombat somehow.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's in this in that.
Yeah,
in that
it's
area.
In the cheese zone, and I think that's fine. That's exactly where it belongs.
Yeah, but I like it. I had fun watching it. Like, there's some slow parts, but it's also from a time when movies were just slower.
I will say the 4K version of this movie, very nice. Those colors pop when those big splash screens happen. They look nice.
Yeah, like the animated bits in particular look fantastic.
Yeah. Well, that is Creepshow, but that is far from our final horror anthology for the month of October. It's just our first. And next up is another more recent anthology. This is Trick or Treat, a 2007 film that has achieved some cult status, mostly by virtue of the fact that it spent like 2 years going around to different festivals and like never got a theatrical release, finally came out, and then a bunch of people were like, hey, this is actually pretty good. I don't know exactly why it had such a weird, troubled history of getting out there to people, but it found its audience eventually, and I will say, it's pretty damn solid. It's one that I watched for the first time a few years ago and thought, hey, this is all right. This is fun.
I don't think I've seen this one.
Not a lot of people haven't, I don't think.
Okay.
Yeah, I definitely have not. Sounds like maybe a little more edge to it than this one.
Yeah, I'd say not quite up to the meanness of modern horror, but definitely like it has a little more whimsy than some of the more violent stuff of these days, but the gore is definitely more present in this one.
The meanness of modern horror sounds like a good...
Yeah, that's the book I'm writing.
Yeah.
I don't want to say too much about Trick or Treat, because, again, I've only seen it once, and I don't even necessarily remember everything from it. I just know it has a pretty good cast, and you know, it's one where it's not necessarily just discrete stories. Like, each of the stories that are happening in the anthology are kind of happening simultaneous to each other, but it is multiple different plots that are kind of happening over the course of one Halloween night.
Okay. Like, yeah. I have realized in watching this and then watching the other horror thing I watched this weekend, which I already forgot the name of, It Comes at Night, which wasn't that bad, but I realized I think I might have a horror threshold. I think I might have, like, a thing where it's just, like, I don't know if I'm enjoying, and again, that one wasn't that bad, but, like, I don't know if I'm enjoying some, like, real severe horror, horror.
I'm with you. I kind of like, I want to subject myself to it, and then I get there and I'm like, oh no, this was a bad idea.
Yeah. And so like, I like definitely these goofier ones.
I'm not above straight up hand over the face.
Totally. Mm-hmm. Or just like stare at your partner dead eye, like turn your head like right perpendicular to the screen. I'm just going to look at you while whatever happens on there, and you tell me when it's done.
You might have a couple of those moments during VHS, but I don't think they're going to happen during Trick or Treat. So.
Okay.
Sorry.
Yeah.
I'm very curious about VHS. Like, we almost watched it before we even put this theme together for this podcast. Like, we'll see when we get there.
I almost wonder if we should have done a double feature, because VHS 2, I think, is actually even better than the first one, though I like the first one a fair amount. I have not seen any of the ones after that, because there's like four of those things. There's like a VHS 90s and an 80s one.
Yes, there's a new one. Either if it hasn't come out already, it's coming out like any day now.
Yeah, it's sort of become the new Paranormal Activity in that regard, but those first two are both pretty good to great, generally speaking. So we're doing the first one, we're sticking with that, but maybe we'll come back around for VHS 2 at some point.
Yeah. Also, I will say, when I get back in town, I am fully intending to go hard on October horror, Shocktober, I guess is the word. So like maybe more horror talk on the Ramblecast here and there.
That's fine by me. And you should hit up Patrick at some point because you know how he loves to make his little horror schedules.
Yes, I need a list for sure.
Patrick Klepek for anyone keeping track at home. But for now, I think that's going to wrap it up. As we said, Trick or Treat is our film for next week. So check that out. And as always, thank you, Brad. Thank you, Vinny.
Thank you.
And thank you to everyone who has been watching, listening, and spooking along with us. We'll see you next time.